sitting here in the Grand Hyatt Hotel with two grand gentlemen of Baltimore and Maryland politics. Tommy D'Alessandro, of course, former mayor of our city, and Ted Venatolis, former Baltimore County executive. Both gone on to do things after politics and survived. They gave us a private room so nobody would see us talking and chase us out. But I did want to do this in all seriousness because the two of you are, I really are legends when it comes to politics in Maryland and people, the names and resounds with people. You've been in politics for a long time. You've been in many conventions. And I think it'd be interesting to hear your perspectives on all the years you've seen conventions, all these years you've seen how politics has played and what's going on now, and just your own perspectives on all this. And so first start with Tommy. I mean, when did you start coming to conventions? What was the first convention you came to?
The first convention I came to was the most dramatic in the history of conventions. In 1948, when Truman was nominated for re-election and for presidency. That was the time, in fact, the Maryland delegation was sitting right in front of those 10 southern states that came out, bolted from the floor of the convention, the Dixiecrats under Strom Thurmond. They left. They just bolted from the convention floor, just left. And then the then existing vice president of the United States was a fellow by the name of Henry Wallace. He filed as an independent on the left. So Wallace was cutting into the Democratic vote on the left, and the Dixiecrats are leaving with 10 states on the right. About 3 o'clock in the morning, Truman came out to make his acceptance speech. A nice white Palm Beach suit on, a black tie, and he made one of the greatest speeches of predicting victory in the midst of all this turmoil and all this defection. I'll never forget it. It was the greatest convention of all time in my book.
Now, what were you doing there then? Were you a delegate? Were you?
My father was a delegate, and I was next to my father on the floor. It was terrific.
Have you missed any since then?
Well, I went to in 68 when I think the convention in Chicago, the notorious convention in Chicago, I was there as a delegate, and I was in San Francisco. I was in Atlantic City. I'll tell you a great story about Atlantic City. At that time, I went before the Democratic Site Selection Committee, and we were then advocating a stay-at-home convention because it could look like it was going to be Kennedy and Johnson again. So Dave Lawrence, who was the chairman of the selection committee, had hearings, and I went over to Washington to make our presentation for Baltimore and Washington stay-at-home convention, the amount of hotel rooms that we had, the whole ball of wax, and what makes us attractive. And after I got through making my presentation, Dave Lawrence, former the mayor of Pittsburgh, and then at that time governor of Pennsylvania, said, "Tommy, where would you like to be in August, Washington, Baltimore, or Atlantic City?" So I said, "No comment." I ruined my presentation.
And Ted, what about your history? Where did you start with this with convention?
I thought an exciting convention was the 1960 Kennedy-Johnson convention because there was a lot of turmoil and tension. Not so much about Johnson and Kennedy, because Kennedy, I pretty well wrapped it up, but who was his running mate going to be, and the pressure for Lyndon and others, and the kind of confusion in the Kennedy camp about whether they wanted to take Lyndon Johnson. There was a lot of opposition. In the end, Kennedy said, it's Johnson. And I was a kid then, just literally at college, and it was just a great, for me at that time, a great convention because it was my first.
What were you doing there?
I was a graduate student in school, and I was there actually doing advanced work for the Kennedy guys, and we were there as part of the convention. We were kids. We did everything. You know, we mopped the floor, whatever they asked us to do. But since then, I don't think I've missed a convention. Not only that, when I was doing the television stuff, I attended the Republican conventions as well. And I'll tell you, there's a marked difference. Democratic conventions are much more colorful, much more exciting, much more ribald, much more. Republicans are pretty staid. You know, it's not, you know, it's pretty stiff. You know, it is. It's a big difference. I was pleased I had the opportunity to go to both of them.
When you talked about 1960 and 1948, and again in 1964 in Atlantic City, and you were at 68, you, Tommy D'Alessandro, was at 68. America's changed so much in the couple of generations since you've been going to conventions. And, you know, the Dixiecrats bolted in 1948 over race. The progressives started angry on the left. You had 1960 when the civil rights movement was just beginning, and John F. Kennedy, this great beacon of hope, was nominated for president of the United States, became president, as we all know. 64 in Atlantic City with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and Fannie Lou Hamer fighting to get seats in the convention to unseat the Mississippi delegation.
The great speech by Bobby Kennedy in 1964. Remember that, Tommy? I mean, they gave him maybe a 30-minute ovation. It was a dramatic moment at that convention because, you know, he had been challenging Lyndon Johnson for the presidency, but that was a remarkable occasion. It reminded me of the speeches we've heard here at this convention, Hillary last night and Michelle and Ted Kennedy, which is a phenomenal, phenomenal moment here.
And I want to talk about those speeches in a minute. And so I'm curious, though, here we have this convention in 2008. Your thoughts about where you've seen it all go. Tommy, I mean, you were mayor during the riots in 68, and I know that affected you deeply personally from everything I've heard you say about that. And now we have an African-American being nominated as for President of the United States on the Democratic Party ticket. First Lady could be an African-American woman, Michelle Obama, who just spoke. And I just would like you to reflect for a minute on those changes that you've seen. You know, you both grew up on the east side of Baltimore, you know, ethnic Baltimore, seeing the changes have gone through, and they've been immense in our lifetime. And I'm just curious how you're affected by all that and what your analysis of all that is, Tommy.
Well, first of all, it's a movement for the good. If the Lord wills and Barack Obama becomes president of the United States, I think he'll dissolve a tremendous amount of disbelief or hatred. I don't even use the word hatred. The racial tension. I think a lot of that will be dissolved, not completely disappear from the center of politics, but it will be diminished. So this is the evolution of the civil rights movement and the signing of the civil rights bill by Johnson in 64, and it is really the stepping stone by which the blacks in this country have an opportunity to move forward, just like every other ethnic group did. That's all it is. It's a step in the right direction. But it's a risk. It's a risk because the elderly primarily are hesitant about taking that risk, you know. But I think the young people throughout the country and the need for a change, facing the issues that we face, I think are going to be the overriding issue in this campaign. And it'll inure to the benefit of Obama.
Ted?
I think Tommy's hit it on the nail. But there are two, in my mind, there are two major shifts that have taken place. One is that the civility in politics seems to have diminished considerably. Not that there was an argument then. There were a lot of argument. In fact, some of the issues are still the same. The two parties are still the same. Republicans have a certain staid conservative view. The Democrats have a much more aggressive view in terms of government and what it should do and how it should help people. So that's one. The argument seems to have been a lot more personal. I don't know how quite to explain that, but there's not the civility. We used to argue with folks, and then you go out and have a drink with them. That doesn't happen today, okay? The second is the media. The media has made a huge change in what's happened at these conventions. There are mostly now really a good thing is you can see these glorious speeches, and they hit across the country, and you can feel the emotion of both of the parties. But it has made them more more kind of image-oriented events that have no real bearing and kind of celebrity-oriented. And you get all this cantankerous talk by the pundits, few of whom know what in the hell they're talking about, quite frankly. I mean, really, they pontificate on things that they have no sense or knowledge or historical tradition or perspective, and yet they're blabbing away all day and all night long. And I don't know how much influence they have, but there's a lot of unreality to it. I mean, all this business about Hillary Clinton, and she comes out and gives this great speech. Now, they had to fill 24 hours of broadcast, okay? And so they had to kind of make up this division and this lack of unity. So I think those two issues of civility has changed and the media has changed since.
I mean, when I look at the convention, I was sitting up there with the Maryland delegation the last couple of nights, just kind of watching from there and looking at our delegation. We're right behind Louisiana, Minnesota's over here, Ohio's over here. And I look around and I see, like, it's just diversity in this audience that kind of blows my mind. I mean,
That's a reflection of the country. The country is made up of that diversity.
You won't see it at the Republican convention.
No, you don't see it. No.
You won't see it, will you, Tommy? No, you're not even going to be close.
I mean, I saw this. It was funny. I saw it. There's a scene I saw that really blew my mind. I saw this. I wrote about it last night. I saw this Orthodox Jewish delegate bending over and hugging this woman, hello, who he knew, who I knew was she's a state representative. I knew that she was also openly gay, lesbian, out of, you know. And I'm watching this scene with this Orthodox Jewish guy with a yarmulke on, hugging this woman who's an out lesbian, who's a politician.
Democratic Party. Right. Tommy's right.
For a lot of people, say 60 and over, that's tough to understand. It's tough to accept. And that's one of the issues in this campaign.
What about a few? When you say it's tough to accept, your dad was one of the great mayors in the history of the city. He was a congressman before that. He really was. He was like Schaefer, Alessandro Schaefer. Those two names are two of the greatest mayors that Baltimore's ever had. You might want to throw McKeldin in there, but...
You don't forget Tom.
No,
in our region, you have to remember, Tommy was there when all that civil rights battle was taking place. He was right there at the center of it. Open housing, civil rights. It was not easy. And those folks did well, his dad and Schaefer, but none of them had the complexity of the social issues that Tommy had to deal with.
I agree. I think that when you were mayor, I mean, you were in the hottest moment anyone could have been mayor of the city of Baltimore. Just insane.
Right. No question about it.
And you handled it well, but I know it wore on you deeply.
As council president, I introduced every piece of civil rights legislation in the history of Baltimore City. That caused me a tremendous amount of slippage in certain areas. But it wasn't reflected in the elections because I won overwhelmingly as city council president and as mayor. And as mayor, I was only mayor 90 days before the assassination of Martin Luther King, who, by the way, was a friend of mine. I met him a couple of times, been in his company. But I was always of the opinion that if I had been mayor for a year, I think we've been able to withstand any rioting. Because our programs that we just initiated, Model Cities, Community Action, Models, Mayor's Offices out in the neighborhoods, that was just beginning. There was no follow-through, so to speak, as far as them being opened, but they were on the drawing boards. And if a year had passed, then all would have been functioning. A display on the part of government, is a manifestation of what government is like as the people want it, not as the mayor wants it. I didn't have that time.
That moment, without probing too deeply, because we're talking about the convention, but I mean, that moment, I always got the sense, I said it earlier a couple of times, I mean, it affected you deeply. I mean, you could have been mayor as long as you wanted to be mayor. I mean, it really kind of, I always felt it really kind of hit you in your heart what happened at that moment.
Well, to some degree, but what, I always wanted to be mayor of Baltimore because my father before me, and that was like my world. That's what I wanted to be. But the reason I left politics was never attributed. A lot of people attributed it to the riots, but that was not the case at all. I had five children, all of them in different degrees of education, high schools, on their way to college, grammar school, and I was making $646 every 2 weeks as mayor of Baltimore.
$646 every 2 weeks as mayor of Baltimore?
That's right. My salary is $25,000 a year, and then if you take out Social Security and all the other stuff, I was getting $696 every 2 weeks. So from a financial point of view, I couldn't continue. I had planned to run for governor against Spiro Agnew. As mayor of Baltimore, I figured I could win a primary to get the nomination and take on Spiro Agnew, who, by the way, even though he was disgraced, he was a good friend of mine. And he was a great governor as far as the relationship with the city, as far as mayor is concerned. I had open carte blanche to him. I didn't have to go to the legislature. I would go right to the mansion when he was there.
See what I mean about the lack of civility today? Now, here's a Democratic mayor having a very close relationship with a Republican governor that he might even run against. But it did not interfere with their policy judgments or with their personal relationship. I want you to think about when Bob Ehrlich was governor and Martin O'Malley was mayor. I mean, the tension and the, you know, the criticism and the arguments that occurred, there wasn't any civility to them.
Do you think that, I mean, where does that come from? Do you think the divisions are more intense between Republicans and Democrats now? The vision of where America is going to be, is that different or what?
I think when the Republicans gained control of the Congress, they were a little, let's put it kindly, disturbed over the treatment that they received by Democratic majorities before them. So there was a get-even time. They stripped the Democrats of any solid committee assignments, so to speak, as far as the complete control of the Congress was in their hands. And I don't like to personalize it, but under Gingrich, this animosity thing began to come into play, this separation between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And days gone by, you can have fierce fights, and then, like Ted said, you go to dinner together. That camaraderie was completely eliminated, completely eliminated.
Let me add one element to what Tommy has said. I think the media has been responsible. The pundits that I've talked about are black and white. They're on either side. They're arguing all the time. It's as if that's all there is argument. When I did television years ago, I always tried to give both sides. No one can survive that way today on television or being an analyst or a commentator. You have to have a rigid position. You express it. The other guy has a rigid position. And it's a clash. No positions are rigid. There's got to be some compromise and give and take on both sides. That doesn't make news, though, unfortunately.
In this convention, some of the biggest news now, of course, is people talking about the what's going on with Hillary Clinton and some of her supporters. They're saying close to a third of them are not sure if they're going to vote for Barack Obama, that all this is going on, and the media's been pushing it a great deal. I've been interviewing some of the women and men who support Hillary, and, I mean, in fact, there is this really uncomfortable feeling they have about what's happened. And I wonder, when you look at that politically, just from your years of looking at politics, but also immediately, what do you think is really happening here? And do you think that this is going to affect this election in any kind of deep way?
As the campaign begins to develop, I think you'll see a tremendous amount of conversion from the Hillary Clinton people to Obama, especially with women, because women have much more to lose by an election of McCain and the continuation of the Republican Party and what they stand for as far as their relationship with women. Just about a couple of weeks ago, they just had that bill in the Congress to have women paid on an equal basis with men, and the Republicans knocked it out. They don't want any of that. So the women have to rethink what's best for them, what's best for the country. And getting even for the differences in the primary does not inure to the benefit of them or to the country. So I think this thing will begin to gel. Plus the fact that I really believe, and I told Ted this morning, they have never seen, the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, have never seen a candidate like Barack Obama. Barack Obama is not only a good candidate, but he's well organized. He's better organized than Gore or Kerry or Dukakis or Mondale. This fella is strong. He's strong. If they think, the Republicans think, that they're going to beat him, I think they're sadly mistaken. I think he's a powerhouse.
Ted?
Well, Tommy is absolutely right. We've never seen quite this kind of organization on a presidential level that took him through the primaries. Here's a guy who 8 years ago had his credit card bounce, you know. I mean, and now he's nominated. How did he get that? How did he develop the strength? Not that he was a Harvard, grad and all that. He was a pretty substantial guy, but financially he wasn't well off. organization, I think. He paid attention to organization. He went into these smaller states. He organized the caucuses. That takes skill. You know, you can have a lot of money, but you have to have organizational skill, and he exhibited that to an oomph degree. And I assume, as Tommy said, that they're carrying this out in the general election. You know, in the primary, they predicted every state that they were going into, the outcome of those states, almost down to the percentage points. My bet is that they're doing the same thing now in the general election, and they have a pretty good handle on how they're going to gather those 270 electors.
I'm trying to draw a parallel of the comments I made before and the election of President Truman in 1948. Hillary Clinton, people who are hesitant about going to Obama, in no way can measure to 10 southern states leaving the convention floor and 10 southern states going Republican. There's no comparison. The people who are fearful of Obama because of lack of experience or because of race can't compare to the 10 southern states and the vice president running on the left. Those are dynamite issues. It's a complete diminishing of the Democratic base. I don't see that in this. I don't see that in this. Let's say one-third or one-half of the Hillary Clinton people go wrong. Let's say that. And let's say that one-half of the hesitance of independence because of his race go bad. That's going to be against what Obama's doing. And Obama is like a wave, is almost like a perfect wave that's coming. And I don't think anybody can stop it.
That's a pretty optimistic view of what may happen. Do you have the same one, Ted?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think the party should be pretty optimistic for secondary reasons, actually primary reasons. What the Republicans have done in office is just simply not comfortable for the country. Anybody looks at it. The economy is the worst in a long while. People are suffering out there. They're losing their homes. The global economy is not good for us. We have a deficit that is just unmanageable. You'd think that the one thing the Republicans could do is balance the budget. I mean, as a Democrat, I thought every once in a while Republicans ought to come in because Democrats like to use the government as effectively as they can. Nobody in history has spent money the way these guys have. Huge deficit owned by the Chinese. And I think that's irritated a lot of Republicans. They couldn't handle Katrina. There was something wrong about the tone in which they did Katrina. I think it's essentially because the Republicans don't like government. They don't even like to go in and rescue things when they're under a lot of pressure. The war has dissipated our economy. It's dissipated the money that we have. The other day, the president vetoed this children's health care program, as I recall. He said we couldn't afford it. As Nancy Pelosi has said, the speaker and Tommy's sister said, this is the great country that we are, couldn't afford health care for kids, 10 million American kids, and we're squandering millions of dollars every day in that war. 40 days of that war would have covered the budget for that thing. So I think that's what's critical here. The country is not moving in the right direction.
One of the things that troubles me, although I don't know whether it's true or not, but I heard that the Iraqi government has a surplus.
That's true, Tommy. They're keeping their own oil revenues. They're not giving them the bus. We're subsidizing everything while they're keeping their oil revenues.
So we're going to have to underwrite their infrastructure, rebuild electric facilities, schools, hospitals. They got a surplus, and we're deep in debt. This thing is crazy. This thing is crazy.
I think it's interesting when people listen to this later. The thing that struck me listening to two of you is all the experience the two of you have had in politics and in life and in business, the world you've been in. And the historical perspective is important to kind of realize just because you're in this, people think they're in the midst of a crisis now, it was Hillary Clinton or whatever it is, Barack Obama, that there's a history here that you can kind of think through that goes beyond that, this immediate panic of the moment.
That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. While all this is going on, while we're taping this show, while the pundits are on television talking this and talking that and this and that, while these people are going one way and other people are going another way, Barack Obama is moving deliberate, strong, building his base, and I think that in the final analysis is going to prove an overwhelming victory for him. I really do.
We talked before we started here about the speeches that came the other night. Ted Kennedy, brain cancer, maybe even endangering his own health by getting up on the platform and doing what he did. To me, he's a lion, no matter what. He's just a lion. He just gets up there and does it. And his speech, and then last night, Brian Schweitzer's speech from Montana. That guy, what do you think? What do you all think about what you've heard from the?
I tell you, I roared when, throughout his speech. I was just in ecstasy. He's my kind of guy. I tell you, one of the things that happened this morning, I was having breakfast, and right below me, he was having breakfast, but I didn't know it. So as he left, somebody told me that was the governor of Montana. I would have loved to have been able to go down and talk to him and tell him what a great job he did. He electrified the convention floor.
He was a hell of a warm-up act for Hillary. I'll tell you, he was just there. Tommy's right. He was an unusual performer in that there's a fellow from Montana, you know, allegedly, you know, rural, low-key. You can picture him out there with his boots and having a beer. But he was, he reminded me of those old times. I wasn't there. But William Jennings Bryan kind of, you know, 16-1, silver to gold, cross of gold speech or whatever it was. I mean, it was that kind of barnstorming rhetoric, but real. I mean, this guy, he believed you. You could feel it.
This educational background. I think he has a doctorate degree in science or chemistry.
Agricultural science, something like that. Yeah, he's a farmer.
Yeah, great.
I mean, it was I'm watching him and then thinking about Ted Kennedy's speech and the women senators who got up yesterday. I mean, it was really kind of, it was inspiring to see that and to be able to kind of, you could feel it coming up from under. One of the things I thought about listening to that and the thing I was going to talk to you two guys today is that there's something about one of the messages coming out of this convention that has to do with an American tradition of kind of hard work and getting somewhere. And, you know, Brian Schweitzer talking about his dad never went to college and Barack Obama's story and all these stories coming up of people who, and like two of you, I mean, you know, you both worked really hard. I mean, your dad was mayor, but you guys worked hard. You grew up in the east side of Baltimore. And
was a janitor at the steel mills for many years. Worked like hell to send his kids to college. I mean, it's where we came from. Tommy, the same way.
My father worked for the city in the sewer department on President Street and Eastern Avenue. I think he was making $15 a week, if that. So we know what poverty is. In fact, regardless of your political accomplishments or political strength, that doesn't reflect that you got a good financial statement. But I always say you don't judge people by their financial statement. Don't judge people.
So as you look back in all the time that you spent in public service and also in working in businesses, looking, you never stopped being political analysts, even when you weren't elected to office. You've always been, it's been part of who you are. What do you think about where we're going to go? I mean, what do you think we're about to leap off to in the future, given what you've seen of this American past in your own lives? And I'm just curious where you think we're going to go here.
Well, you've got to take into consideration with every year that passes, there's people who are dying and people who are being born. And I think the tremendous acceleration in technology, communication, where if a guy burps in Tokyo, you hear it in Baltimore in a minute, in a second. The whole complexion of life as we know it is going to change. It really is going to change. And we have to adopt that stuff. And I think in that change, a lot of the boogeymans that we were concerned about are going to evaporate. I think there's going to be a tremendous acceptance of the diversity of different races and different religions and different people. It has to be. Because we all have to work together and live together on this globe and maybe have to come up jointly or collectively with solutions to preserve the universe. And as you see now, the great strength of China, of India, of the European nations, we are no longer non-competitive. We have a non-competitive arena. We have to fight for what we're going to get in the future. And I think it's going to sink in.
That's a really important point that Tommy just made. When you think about the future, that you all grew up and I grew up, I'm just a little younger than you all, not that much, that grew up in a time when America was the absolute dominant economic military force on the planet Earth. That's not the way anymore. So we do have to, Tommy, say, think about where this is going in a very different way.
Well, it's a mistake, I think, to think that we have to continue to be the dominant military force. The dominant force we have to be is in our values, the great things that made the country. And we've lost some of those. That's why people respect us. Not because we can beat them over the head with a club or with a military regiment or something, okay? So I want to add to what Tommy has said. I think that we've got issues to cope with that are just phenomenal and profound. And the two parties have a real responsibility to try to meet those issues. They're changing rapidly. They're confusing. You've got new communication systems. You'd be able to email people. We were in France not long ago. I could email back to my office. I mean, we emailed, right. It's all, I mean, all this, the financial global structure, as Tommy was mentioning, there's so much going on so quickly that it's difficult for us to comprehend, and the parties have to at least stay even. They really should be ahead of this. And that's why I think the Democratic Party and what we're after is so critical. I don't think the Republicans, because of their essential, and it's okay, they have a different sense of government and different sense of where to go. John McCain wants to continue essentially what's out there. But that's not good enough for what's happening out there. That things are passing by. At least I think the Democrats are trying as best they can to cope with some of these issues and to stay with them. And I'm not even sure that we're strong enough to do that, okay? But at least the one party is trying. And if we don't do that, I it's going so fast. Never mind what you said about losing our global military strength or our global reputation. It'll be worse than that. The American era may be over, and we don't want that. The world doesn't want that. The world needs America to be the country that exhibits its values to the rest of the world, because those values are so great. There's been no other country in the history of the world that vanquished its foe in World War II and then spent money to rehabilitate those foes to get them back even. No one did a Marshall Plan or a Truman Doctrine. We did it. Country, great Americans. And that's the kind of attitude I think we have to take forward. So.
Very well said. Very well said. The thing that disturbs me a little bit when you hear the question of race in this contest is I remember very vividly in 1964 in the convention in Atlantic City, at that time when Johnson was nominated, Goldwater was the Republican nominee, and I knew Senator Goldwater, and he was a great guy personally. But he openly and notoriously put into the Republican platform anti-civil rights. They were against civil rights in 1964. And I think some of that may still exist, and it'd be personified against Obama. So we're in a changing era. I think an Obama victory would open up this country and the world to a new tomorrow. Our acceptability around the country would be enhanced. You see the reception he got in Germany. It's unbelievable, almost like JFK. So we just got to hope and pray, speaking as a Democrat, that everything works our way. But I don't repeat, while we're talking, and while the pundits are talking, and while everybody else is waiting for the Republican convention and the end of the Democratic convention, Obama is working.
Gentlemen, this has been great. I really do appreciate it. Sitting here with the two of you has been a real joy. Wish I could do it more, but they got to use this room, and you got more of a day to go to. Thank you both so much. Tommy Donaldson, Senator III, Ted Venatoulis, it's been a pleasure to be with you both.